Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today has worked in the video game industry for 20-plus years with a large amount at this small publisher called Capcom. You may have heard of them. You may know them. He's unique in being an American living in Japan, can speak fluent Japanese, and if he's not working or spending time with his family, he's totally devoted to gaming. You can probably tell by all those games in the background there. I'd like to welcome David Crislip. How you doing?
Good. How are you? I was going to say good morning, but is it morning? What morning for you as well?
It's afternoon.
Afternoon. Okay.
Yeah, but it's good though because the time difference actually isn't that bad.
No, not compared to the States or Europe. I'm usually very odd hours sometimes dealing with folks over there.
Yeah, and we're a day ahead, so I have to plan.
Yeah, exactly.
And think, I'm like, okay, so I'm actually a day before them. So when they say the 19th, it's actually the 20th for me. And yeah, so I still have to work around that. So when I looked at the time difference between here and Osaka, I was like, oh, it's actually not that bad.
It's not so bad.
No. So I think the most obvious question is, when did you decide to learn Japanese?
So it goes back a while, right? When I was a little kid, they were talking late 70s, early 80s. I watched a lot of Japanese cartoons, as we did in those days. Battle of the Planets, which was the localized version of Gatchaman, was a favorite. Transwar Z, Voltron, all the favorites. And I had a vague, even as a kid, I had a vague sort of awareness that this was Japanese entertainment, that this was not homegrown, so to speak. But it wasn't until I got into video games that it really kind of cemented for me that a lot of the things that I liked were from Japan. I was a Sega Master System kid. I was not a Nintendo Entertainment System kid. And I remember finishing Space Harrier, which was one of the hardest versions of that game. I don't think I could finish it now, but I managed when I was 12 or 13. Closing credits come up. I see it's mostly Japanese names and just something kind of clicked in my head. It's like, okay, I like the cartoons from there. I like the video games from there. I sure would like to go there one day, learn that language, work in the game industry, meet some of these people whose names I'm seeing. So from a really young age, I had wanted to study Japanese. When I got to university, you know, it seemed like a cool thing to do. I never really thought it was a realistic goal. So I kind of shelved it in the back of my mind as something, you know, wouldn't it be cool if I could do that as opposed to, I'm going to do that. But I got to university, took a Japanese course at first, mainly just wanted to get a good grasp of katakana so that I could read the spines of my import Saturn games and know which game was which without having to pull it out and flip it over. Didn't necessarily think I would get fluent until one day I did because I just kept at it for so long. Yeah. Games and pop culture generally were the influence for me.
So how long would you say it takes to learn fluent Japanese to be proficient at it?
Sure. I mean, obviously it depends on the person and your specific aptitude for language and how your brain is wired, et cetera. But I mean, years and years, obviously it's not something that we've done quickly. I think immersion typically, you know, again, everyone's got different learning styles, but immersion typically is the way to kind of shortcut it. If you live in Japan for a year or 2 years or 3 years, that's equivalent to much, much longer of, you know, desktop study, right? I didn't feel confident and anything that I would call approaching fluent until I had, you know, I'd studied in university for Japanese for 3 or 4 years. I lived in Japan for a year on a study abroad program. At the end of that, I was moderately confident. 2 or 3 years of living here, living my daily life here after that, then I finally kind of started to, okay, I can speak Japanese. I can read and write Japanese now. So for me personally, maybe what, 5, 6 years or something before I had any degree of confidence.
Right. Because I suppose living in Japan, it kind of pushes you into a corner. You have to survive.
Exactly. If you've got no choice, if you need it to pay your gas bill, if you need it to socialize in any way or get a haircut, you pick it up pretty quick out of necessity, right?
Yeah. So when you went to Japan, you were an English teacher first, right?
Yeah. After my study abroad program, I came back as an English teacher. Very, very common way, probably still certainly 20 years ago, like the most common way for Westerners to get to Japan.
Right.
Easy way to get a visa. Your housing is arranged for you. And then a lot of us end up sticking around doing other stuff after.
So how did you end up at Capcom then? English teacher to localizer at Capcom?
I mean, again, it was always my plan when I came over to teach English. It was like a 3-year contract, a renewable up to 3 years. And my plan was to kind of goof off for the first year and do whatever. Second year, I wanted to pass the second level Japanese proficiency test. Third year, I would pass the first level, the top level Japanese proficiency test, and then get a job in games. That was kind of my plan. The testing part went well. I was winding down my third year of teaching. I'm like, oh man, I can I really do this? Can I pull this off? I suppose I could always just get another English teaching job. But like anything in this industry or any other, it's a combination of luck and timing and connections.
So I suppose when you first joined, it was a sink or swim sort of thing, because you wouldn't have known anything about localization before you started doing it.
No, not really. I hadn't even played a game in English at that point. Did 5 or 6 years right there. I was playing games in Japanese at the time. It was very new to me. I think being bilingual is one thing. Knowing how to translate is another. Knowing how to localize, which is kind of a step beyond that, is another. And then just the tech requirements. So what I mean by that is, character limits, right? You've only got a certain amount of memory devoted to on-screen text. It's probably less of an issue now, but certainly like in the PS2 era, the Game Boy Advance era, you can't go over the character limits. It won't fit on the screen. It could cause a memory leak, et cetera. So not only do you have to say what the character's saying, you've got to say it in 28 characters or less and with the line break at a certain place. So that's kind of a whole other added layer that I had no insight into, no knowledge of whatsoever before I started actually doing it.
Right, because the old school way you traditionally hated, right, where you had word A means word B. Which you hated, and you prefer to try to embellish the meaning in English, right? That's your approach to it. Easier said than done, absolutely. Though.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%. Yeah, it's, I think there's, gaming fans, whether you're watching anime, whether you're playing games, the natural inclination of an English speaker is to assume that a direct translation is the best way. They want the unvarnished, exactly, word A equals word B sort of thing. But I don't know that they think they want that. I don't know that they actually do. I mean, you end up, if you really did it that way, it would come off like, not even like modern DeepL, would come off like Google Translate 10, 15 years ago. It'd be very robotic, very stiff. You would lose any semblance of humor. You would lose any semblance of characterization. My approach has always been get the core meaning across, get the characterization across. If there's a laugh line, by all means, preserve that laugh line. Translating a joke, for instance, word for word, it's not going to make sense culturally to the other person reading it. So it's just kind of pointless, right?
Yeah, I did a podcast last week with Ryan Kaufman. He did a lot of the writing on those interactive Telltale games. And he was talking about... Yeah. How if you try to translate, say, a cowboy, and they're talking, this town ain't big enough for the two of us, trying to translate that directly to Japanese, it wouldn't work, would it?
No, it would sound ridiculous.
So what do you do in those type of scenarios?
I mean, you put yourself in the character's head, you think about here's what's happening in this scene, here's how it would play out in my culture, based on my literary tropes and my film tropes, my understanding of how characters behave in this scenario, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But that sounds easier said than done, though.
Oh, 100%. And it's, there's the way Japanese works, we talked about the character limits, the way Japanese works, it's a very dense language. It's very easy to get across a lot of that sort of characterization, the sort of contractions someone uses, the pronouns they use to describe themselves and other people. You can instantly kind of tell this person's from Osaka, or this person is juvenile or an old man, or they're a samurai. There's just so many different kinds of speech patterns you can cram into very, very small utterances. And I don't know that English has that same ability, right? So you've got to find really kind of creative ways to characterize.
Yeah. And I suppose it depends on the game as well, right? I mean, Mega Man would be a hell of a lot easier, I would think, than say Resident Evil.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yes.
So what would how long would localizing a game in the old days take to now, do you think?
I don't know that there's much. I guess the big difference now is there's probably because of all the file sharing tools and people can share files securely and localization tools. There's probably a lot more, I guess, kind of real time sharing. But back in the day, it was a bit more. Methodical, a bit more slow, very iterative. Typically localization will start, I think in the old days, in the Famicom era, basically the game was done and then they would localize it and sell it a year or two later in the West. And I think that definitely changed in the 32 bit era or before, where it was more of a process that happened simultaneously with the rest of development, right? So you're handed a script, you're handed in-game text, the game is not nearly done, definitely subject to change. Portions might be cut, they might come back and say, well, this puzzle has changed. Now it's no longer three bottles you have to move, it's two. Please change this text to match that sort of thing. So it's very You know, it happens during production, the bulk of production, maybe half of the game's dev cycle. That's kind of happening simultaneously, probably.
Man, it sounds so complex. And I suppose it's even harder now because I suppose back in the day you had release dates scattered, right? So Japan's release date would be different from Europe's, which would be different from America's, whereas now they tend to be released all on the same day.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
In any country, right? So
yeah.
Would that be, I would think that would be harder, or have tools made it easier, do you think? Or is it a combination of both?
Well, I think they bake those sort of things into the production schedule now, right? Because they know it's coming. They know they have a date that they're aiming for. Yeah, and ultimately a combination of that and tools and information sharing that's just more efficient than it probably was back in the day make that possible.
Yeah.
I mean, the logistics of it are staggering when you look at the, you know, big AAA game now that not only has text translation, but, you know, voice recordings in 8 languages. Just the logistics of getting all that done and ready in time and checked and edited and go through the QA process. I mean, good Lord, that's very daunting. Very, very daunting.
So do you still play games in Japanese if you have the option?
Or do you play in English? If it's a Japanese game, I'll play it in Japanese. If it's a Western game, I'll play it in English typically.
Right. Do you ever switch between the two just to see what the dub is like?
Sometimes, just on a lark, I'll turn subtitles on in English or vice versa, just to, you know, as someone with a localization background, just out of curiosity, what's the modern localization landscape look like these days? How are people handling lines like this? But I do find that distracting, to be honest, too. It's not as immersive for me once you've seen how the sausage is made, so to speak. The food's less appetizing. So I try to not get too bogged down in the localization stuff, because then I'll just think about that and I'll focus on that. And nothing's worse than finding some line that you would have done differently, and then that's all you think about for the rest of the game instead of just enjoying it, right?
Yeah, because I often find that Japanese games that are dubbed in English, the voice acting isn't as good as the original Japanese dub. That's personally how I feel. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the product, obviously. But yeah, I think leaps and bounds ahead of what it was in the early CD-ROM era. Right?
Yeah. Do you have a specific game that you really appreciate the dub for in English that's been translated from Japanese? Yeah.
Good question. I'm actually going to flip it on you, and I'm going to give you an example of a Western game with an exceedingly good Japanese dub.
Okay.
And that would be Ghost of Tsushima. Obviously, they wanted to make that the most genuine sort of localization possible, but I mean, they used period correct Japanese. Like, it sounds like ancient Japanese. The you know, samurai speak in the ways that samurai would speak. Interestingly, I think the PS4 version on initial release, the lip flap matched the English. So it's this weird disconnect. It's samurai. They're obviously in Japan. They're speaking Japanese, but their mouths aren't matching.
Yeah.
By the time that the PS5 version came out, that was kind of an additional feature. They matched the lip flap to whichever language you were playing in.
When did they bring that in, like lip flapping and matching it? Because obviously back in the day, you didn't have the bandwidth or the resources to be able to do that.
No. I mean, you would try your best to match vowel sounds, right? And you would have like a mouth shape for each vowel sound and just kind of try and match them by hand. There's tools now that to a degree can match that, you know, the AI assisted kind of tools. There's always some amount of tweaking by hand to make sure that it matches. And then, of course, you know, if it's a proper cutscene in a big AAA release, there's facial capture now. So when the actor is in the booth, they actually got the dots around their lips or special cameras to capture all that. And then that's just like you do motion capture of someone punching or kicking. That's all kind of baked into the capture process these days.
Is there a part of you that's glad you don't have to work on like a AAA game these days that needs to be translated in multiple languages? You know, it sounds like a nightmare.
It would be daunting. I do miss the creativity involved in localization. But if I were given you know, some kind of task where I had to plan out the entire localization process and book studios in Czechoslovakia to do the Czech dub and things like that, that'd be a lot of work. I don't know that's something I would enjoy.
Yeah. So when you were at Capcom, obviously during your tenure there, you did do a lot of business traveling, right? And I know that
yes, did a lot of travel.
Mm-hmm. So you'd obviously come face to face with immigration officers at customs.
Yes.
And I know there were times where they would geek out over when you tell them that you worked on Street Fighter or Resident Evil. Can you relay any like stories from that? Like a story that resonates with you?
I don't know if I have anything super specific. I mean, it was, you know, they always ask why are you here? And I said, I'm here for a business trip. I work in video games. And you can see their eyes light up, right? Because there's a lot of, I think, younger folk working those sort of jobs at immigration. Or I would have, you know, a Capcom logo or something on my hoodie or on my jumper. And that would get people interested. Oh, did you work on this? Did you work on that? Or are you here to work on a Resident Evil game? Are you doing something with people? Of course, I couldn't answer those questions.
Yeah, of course.
So I did get that frequently. There's coming to Japan. So when I moved to California, I had come back to Japan on a business trip once. And there's a television show in Japan that the whole premise is they ambush, basically, foreigners arriving in Japan and ask, why are you here? What are you doing in Japan? And it's just this show, interesting show. I'm here to learn about cooking. I'm here to meet my friend, whatever. And they happened to catch me at the airport in Osaka. And I panicked a little because I was here for a business trip with Capcom. And I knew I couldn't talk about anything specific, but I had a big old Capcom logo on my shirt. So the jig was up, so to speak. I didn't want to walk away from a TV crew. So I talked around everything, right? I made some jokes, but it was top secret. They'll fire me if I tell you what we're working on, et cetera. And that ended up on TV. But of course, as soon as the crew walked away, I immediately called my boss. I'm like, hey, listen, I just did a TV interview. Is that cool? I believe they actually ended up calling the company and clearing everything with the marketing department and whatnot. I don't
wow.
think that. Yeah, Japanese TV shows are very cautious, I think, about that sort of thing.
Well, Japanese are cautious anyway, right? I even find, like, because obviously I've spoken to a lot of game developers, and Japanese tend to be a lot more strict, even with NDAs, as opposed to the West, right?
Sure.
Yeah, they're
absolutely.
Very, very protective of their IP.
Yes, for sure.
And understandably so, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. What's your favorite Capcom game, out of interest?
I put a lot of thought into this when we were talking about doing this interview and kind of prepping for it. I'm gonna cheat a little bit if that's okay. I'm gonna give
you right.
four separate answers for each golden age of Capcom for this.
All right,
Go back to the 80s, the CPS1 era, the Capcom's first arcade golden age. I'm gonna go with Strider,
nice.
And I'm gonna say specifically because of the giant sprites, the colorful graphics, and what I would describe as kind of my first experiences with set pieces in a video game. We didn't even have a word for set pieces then, right? But it was, instead of, you know, until then it was a game that has an ice level and it's all just, you know, platforms, but they're blue because it's ice. And the desert level, they're platforms, but it's yellow because it's sand. This is like, no, you're running down the side of a mountain and it's every area is bespoke and unique. And there's you run down the side of a mountain and then you climb up a electrical generating plant and there's lightning going around. Then you get up on that helicopter thing, like just very, the moment-to-moment gameplay was so different. It was like watching an action movie, right? More so than playing a game. You know, the gravity would switch off and you had to do that thing where you're swirling around that boss. I didn't see anything like that in games. That was revolutionary. So in the 80s, I would say Strider for sure. In the 90s, the CPS2, CPS3 era, I'd have to go with Street Fighter Alpha 2. Never been super good at fighting games. I can beat the hell out of the CPU, not good against other people. But I love the characters, love the animation. I love seeing all the endings for all the characters, et cetera. And Alpha 2 really, really, really drove home for me the fun of Street Fighter. I played that game so much on Saturn that actually I blew out the motor in my Saturn that it spins the disc. It actually broke, and I had to have it repaired. That's
wow.
how much I played Street Fighter Alpha 2.
Did you play at the arcades much in Japan? Have you played that?
In Japan, I did,
it's
yeah.
Still, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In the States, it was by the time the Alpha series came around, it was on the cusp of kind of going out. I was lucky there was an arcade on my university campus, but they were not as common as they were in the 80s, for sure.
Yeah.
And then, of course, going into the 2000s, Resident Evil 4, obviously, it goes without saying.
Good pick. Good pick.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so much perfect about it. It's the pacing, it's just perfectly punctuated. The tense action scene, a little bit of exploration. I mean, it's basic game design 101 stuff, but it's done so, so well. Like, I find that game compelling in the literal sense of the word. Like, I feel absolutely compelled to keep playing it. I can't put it down and walk away from it. I still love that game to this day. And then in the more modern era, maybe in the 2010s, Dragon's Dogma still blows my mind. I think even in 2024, if you were to tell me someone was making a game that's like, you know, it's got that high speed, you know, Capcom style action controls and combos, something that like Devil May Cry style combos, but it's an open world RPG. Even in 2024, I'd say that sounds pretty ambitious. I don't think someone could make that. It's got to be one or the other. But they did that more than a decade ago, man. That still blows my mind. Super pumped about the sequel. It's awesome that it's coming next month. So,
You mentioned Resident Evil 4. Did you play the remake?
I did, yeah.
I just finished it earlier this week. I finally got around to playing it. It's amazing.
Nice. Yeah. It's, you know, I had my doubts because it's already, how do you remake a perfect game?
Exactly.
But they did it. And
they
it
did
was
it.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you glad you didn't have to translate, do any of the localization on that?
Again, there's so much nostalgia in having been able to do stuff like that. But yeah, it is nice to sit back and enjoy it as a consumer and not get bogged down or stressed about the work involved.
Well, yeah, because I suppose, because you worked on the original Resident Evil 4, I suppose there is a part of you that probably looks at it with a fine-tooth comb, right? Because you worked on it. You know how the sausage was made, so to speak. So you can't appreciate it the way you would as a consumer.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard to completely flip that switch off and go with something like a pure consumer. It's almost impossible.
Yeah. So when you were working on Resident Evil 4, were you aware that Capcom was making something really special with that?
Yeah, firstly, I should preface, I don't want to take too much credit for Resident Evil 4. My involvement was fairly minimal. I did the translation for the script parts for the Ada section that got added on PS2. So I don't want to give the impression that I made that game. I most certainly did not tangentially involve, but I do remember a very palpable sense within the company, among the dev team, and even people outside that team directly. I think there was an awareness that this was something special. I think there was just something in the air. Everybody knew that they'd nailed this, right? This wasn't just going to be, you know, Capcom's always been good at making sequels and iterating on an existing theme, but something this revolutionary was something special. I think we did kind of, I knew this was going to be big. I don't think anybody could have predicted how influential it would be in terms of, you know, the third person camera angle that obviously existed prior to that. It was super, super popularized after RE4. I don't think anyone could have predicted how influential it would be, but I think they knew that this was not just another run of the mill sequel. This is something really, really special.
Yeah. Well, it's the pacing as well. The phenomenal pacing.
Absolutely.
In that game, absolutely, right? From the tutorial and, up to the end, it's just and even with the remake, same thing. It's just
absolutely, and there's the courage to pull away from existing canon for a little bit, and oh, a bunch of years have passed, and Umbrella's not even a thing anymore, and it takes place in Europe, and just after the president's daughter, he's not going after zombies. This whole to really flip the script and clean slate it like that took a lot of guts, I think. I think a lot of folks would have wanted or expected, you know, a direct sequel to 3-Year Code Veronica or something, and to have a take on such a different sort of look and feel, I think took a lot of guts.
I know you have a lot of friends that are still there, but it must feel good, even though that you're not at Capcom anymore, to see them kind of go through this renaissance of sort, right? Because obviously they were in dire straits for a bit, and then RE7 and the RE engine, and that kind of kickstarted this whole banger after banger, and they're just, they're on fire, firing on all cylinders, I would say.
Absolutely. No, it's super gratifying to see. You know, I do still know plenty of people. I live in Osaka currently, which is Capcom town. I don't know two ways about it. No, it's incredible. It's like, I know it's like watching a football team of a school you used to go to do really well kind of thing, right? I mean, it's
always... it's still your team, right? So you're still
I always remember my roots there. And again, I do still know folks there, but it's there's a lot of ways to screw up in the industry and very few ways to have everything go really well. And they've consistently in the last decade, and you're really going back for decades, really, if you take the long view of it, they've consistently just knocked it out of the park. They've made the right decisions over and over again. I've been really rooting for them.
Yeah. Well, I think their tenure in the industry could be studied, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
If any studio or publisher is struggling, just look at Capcom.
Yeah.
As the template. Because... Yeah. Mm-hmm. They know when to pivot when something isn't working, and once they get it right, they just bang, 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 bang. Yeah,
and just a really healthy mix, I think, of new IP and legacy IP, and tweaking the legacy IP just enough to give it modern sensibilities and make it relevant again. I mean, yeah, just so many good decisions back to back.
So, what was your actual favorite Capcom game to work on specifically?
I'm gonna cheat here and give you two answers as well. I think, Street Fighter 4 was a big one because, again, much like RE4, we knew it was going to be something big, that it was going to kind of bring back a semi-dormant kind of brand. And also, you know, I, having grown up with Street Fighter, right, in high school, having played the hell out of Street Fighter 2 and played the Alpha series after that in university, to actually be able to be given the keys to the car, so to speak, and the ability to write lines that these characters that I knew, like, family that I'd known for decades at that point, mm-hmm. to be able to write lines that they're going to say out of their mouths, like, that was an honor. There's no two ways about it. And it was also kind of cool because it was a way to kind of clean up the existing canon. You know, there had been spelling variations in different games and different media, right? Is it Shadow Law or Shadaloo? Is it, you know, a flash kick or a somersault kick for Guile, things like that? So it was nice to be able to kind of make those decisions. Okay, it's Shadowly. Here's how it's spelled from now on. This is canon. This is how we're going to do it. You know, let's kind of tie all the threads together. So that was kind of, was gratifying to sort of clean that up and set the stage for moving forward in the series with in terms of terminology and things like that. Mm. And then the other answer I would give is Dead Rising was a blast to work on. I think because that game was intended to have such a Western and such an American specifically flavor, it was very, very collaborative. The team was very open to listening to my ideas about things, and I could kind of contribute to the script in ways other than kind of traditional localization. So that was super, super gratifying as well.
Yeah, because Capcom are able to westernize things without losing the Japanese flavor, which I think is amazing, particularly like Resident Evil, right? Because not many Japanese publishers or developers make shooters. It's not really a thing.
No, exactly.
Just like, wow.
I mean, even the original theme of the zombies in a mansion is a very Western trope, before Walking Dead and all the other zombie stuff kind of took off in the last couple of decades. There hadn't been any big zombie media in a long time, right? Yeah. Let alone in Japan. So it was what a wild decision for them to go with that. Yeah.
How did you end up voicing Winston Payne? How did that
happen? That was, again, a matter of right place at the right time. They needed to quickly record a few lines and were open to using staff to do that. So I was literally sitting at my desk, typing away, localizing something, tap on the shoulder. Hey, you got an hour to come record a couple of lines for a game. Okay. Like that's basically how it went down. Yeah. Essentially. The sound director had very specific ideas of what he wanted. So it did. It took an hour or two, right? Just for those few, just screeching objection over and over, because it was, I'm not an actor by trade. They all sounded exactly the same to me, but to his ears, every take was a little different until they found what they.
So was that your first time actually recording voiceover lines?
I think at that point, I had probably, when I was in LA to help record lines for games, I think there'd been a time or two where I'd hopped into the booth just to do a scream or a hey you, that fight sounds, that sort of thing, just on a lark. So I'd done that, I think, a couple of times. It was the first time I think I'd had a proper line. Yeah.
So you basically went in blind for the most part. You
were like,
what am I doing here? Okay, I'll just do
pretty
what
much.
He says.
Yeah.
And it turned out well.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, we actually did a French version as well. And I don't speak French. So I had there was an objection. I had to kind of try my
good
best
exit.
To do that. There was a French guy on staff that helped coach me through that. I think it took longer to do that line than the English line, more than likely.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Well, it's good that you can do it, because some people find that stuff very intimidating, right? Standing in a booth with a mic there and you don't really move,
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So you did pretty well.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of when you're translating, there's a difference between translating text and dialogue, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what would be the biggest challenges between, say, text versus dialogue?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So when you're talking text, let's say we're talking subscreen text or something like that. It's not a description of an item or a weapon. Those really are kind of word for word more textbooky, right? This is a 9mm handgun. It's black. Whatever all the text description things like that. The herb heals in Resident Evil, that sort of thing. Those are much more straightforward. You still have to worry about the character limits, maybe even more so on subscreens. But it's very straightforward. When you're talking about characters, again, you get into the idea of characterization. A character's only got so many lines in a game. How do I make it clear, that this character, for example, is from the countryside, or that this character is, an experienced fighter, et cetera. Ways to kind of convey that in a very economical way, in a very short blurb of text. That's where the challenge really comes in. Because again, Japanese is so dense with meaning that a very short line can carry all sorts of extra kind of built-in meaning. It's what's unsaid can be as important as what's said, I think, in Japanese. So parsing that and finding a way to get those character interactions across, again, in a small amount of text, right? And then it could be limited to on-screen text. It could be limited to maybe it's a dub. And a character said a very short utterance in Japanese, but you need to get across something much longer. Those are always fun. Or vice versa. Yeah.
So what do you think is the biggest misunderstanding gamers have then about localization? Because I'm sure you may have read stuff online and you probably get a little bit frustrated you're like, that's not how it is.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think one thing, again, the idea that you know, direct translation is the correct way to do it, and then they don't need the extra flavor and spice when in actuality, for it to function as a compelling work of fiction, it actually does need that extra layer. I think a misconception I see a lot, you know, on Twitter and places like that is that the localization is somehow kind of separate from development and it's encapsulated in its own thing, and that they can somehow alter or ruin the game or alter it in ways that the dev team would not approve of, when in reality, you know, your mileage may vary depending on team structure, but it typically is a very, very collaborative process, right? There's a lot of back and forth with the script writers and then the folks that are making the game. Hey, I don't think this line works in English for this reason. Do you mind if I kind of change it up this way? Sometimes those changes actually make it back into the Japanese script as a result, right? So it can be very collaborative. Very seldom is there a person locked away in a room, you know, far removed from a dev team, just kind of doing things on their own and making decisions. That's not typically how it works at all, right?
So how long did it take you to adapt to Japanese culture when you first moved over from America?
So I guess I was lucky in the sense that I've always, I don't know if it's my upbringing or my innate personality, I tend to be on the polite side. I tend to be a little more deferential, the type to hold a door open for someone, to apologize if I bump into them, et cetera. So I guess that kind of put me at an advantage because I was already, I guess, kind of primed for life in Japan because I tend to be that type of person. Because it is a culture of deference, of apologies, of responsibility taking. I'm the type to show up 10 minutes early for a date or an appointment, that sort of thing, right? And that's of utmost importance here. So it wasn't super, super hard to adapt in that sense. I mean, I came over at first as a university student, so my life didn't change that much. I still ate garbage food and drank a lot and played a lot of video games. There was not a huge difference there. You know, and even getting into the working world, my only work experience aside from, you know, part-time work, you know, at a toy store during university, my only work experience at that point had been in Japan. So it was hard for me to parse what was Japanese office culture and what was just what it means to work as an adult. Looking back now, I think I can very clearly tell what the differences are. There's the culture of, you know, you don't want to be the first one to leave the office. So a lot of people are kind of watching the clock. 6 o'clock rolls around, 7 o'clock rolls around. If your boss is still there, you're not going anywhere. That sort of stuff, clearly very Japanese, but I don't know that I knew at the time, right? Yeah.
So how long did it take you to learn that was frowned upon?
You pick that up pretty quick. It's obvious when you make a faux pas. Yeah.
Really? Does someone pull you aside and be like, hey, or do you just learn from just paying attention to the situation?
Case by case, right? I've definitely had people pull me aside and be like, hey, man, just so you know, I wouldn't have said what you said in that meeting just now. That happens. Sometimes you just have to kind of read the room, so to speak, right? You know, body language. Ooh, that guy doesn't look very happy with me. It's probably that thing that I did yesterday. And you kind of intuit it and feel your way around the situation.
Right. So I imagine at this point, you got this down. You understand the culture.
I mean, I still sometimes, you know, I'll go into a meeting and there's a lot of rules about where you sit in a meeting, right? If you're the guest versus if you're the host. The hierarchy of rank and who sits closest to the door and which side of the table.
Really?
More or less got a handle on that, but there's still times I walk in the room and I panic and I'm like, they're not here yet, so I've got to decide where to sit. I'm a guest here, so I should sit farther from the door and I should sit to the left of this guy. Yeah, it can be complicated.
Wow, that sounds overwhelming.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
So when you went back to California for a brief period, were you able to just go back into American culture quite fluently, or Japanese mindset?
I definitely had, I guess, what you would call, you know, reverse culture shock, so to speak. I didn't, you know, just little mannerisms I didn't realize I was even doing. I'd bow on the phone, which you tend to pick up in Japan, and I had people point that out to me and laugh. Or if I would see a friend of mine, I wanted to kind of do a greeting without waving. You know, I think in the West, certainly in the States, kind of put your chin up, hey, what's up? And in Japan, you would be more differential and bow. So I would do a lot of this and people thought that was weird. And I had to retrain myself to do the upward chin wag instead of a downward sort of thing. Just little things like that. The biggest change to me, I think, was just the sheer amount of space, right? The width of the roads and the size of the cars and the size of the food portions. I had to get reaccustomed to that. That took a little while.
Right. And obviously the public transport in America is not that great compared
almost
to Japan.
Yeah, I was lucky where I was in Northern California. We had trains and whatnot, but not like here, not like where they run so punctually and so frequently. Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't have to drive there, would you?
No. I do drive now just because of the neighborhood I live in, but I lived in Japan 10 years prior. I never had a car. Yeah, there's you could basically throw a dart at a map of Japan and you could probably get to that place solely with the public transportation relatively easily. Maybe need a taxi for the last couple kilometers of the leg of the trip, but you're gonna find a station nearby.
Yeah. Would you say it's quite difficult to get a job at Capcom? I know you've mentioned in the past that there were two veteran developers that you knew that tried to apply for a job at Nintendo, and that was really, really hard. Right?
Yeah, it's exceedingly hard to get into Nintendo from what I can tell. I think it depends on the type of job you're after. It depends on the need at the time. I think certainly, the bigger the company, the more stringent that hiring process is going to be. I think I was lucky because I was there weren't a ton. It was a new fledgling localization team. There weren't a ton of people there yet. I don't know that I necessarily had the magnifying glass on me the way folks might now.
Probably now, yeah. You probably go through multiple interviews now, I would think.
Yeah, any job in Japan, you've got 2, 3, 4 interviews almost for sure. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Sounds daunting.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be. It can be. And there's still the tradition of you've got a handwritten resume. So if you're applying to 10 different companies, you've got to spend an afternoon writing out your CV 10 times by hand. You attach a photograph to it, which feels, as a Westerner, kind of strange. Like they're going to judge you based on looks, or I don't know, but it's just tradition. You have to, and it's got to be a certain amount of millimeters and dimensions that to be stapled in a certain way or glued in a certain way to the resume. Yeah, it's a different world from the West for sure.
But are Japanese people aware of Western culture? Because I get the
feeling
that they are.
By and large. Yeah, by and large. I think if nothing else, for better or for worse, American popular culture and Hollywood movies, et cetera, have really kind of dominated a lot of pop culture globally, right? So if nothing else, there's an awareness. And that, of course, leads to a lot of misunderstandings and stereotypes.
Of course.
Well, yeah.
Over the last year, I've had Japanese students living with us off and on from Osaka, actually. And I just find them some of the most respectful, nice, caring people, just very selfless, I find. And I suppose, have you learned to have more of that since you've been there? Is that subconsciously seeped into you, do you feel?
Yeah, I feel, there's a school of thought and there's been studies about how language itself kind of shapes your behavior and the way you think. The concepts and ideas bouncing around in our head are, in some ways, defined by the words we're using to describe them and not the other way around, if that makes sense. Just the act of speaking Japanese and the act of being aware of, kind of hierarchy and word choices, I think it does put one in a certain mode of thought, right? Where I might be a little more deferential, a little more, apologetic, aware of what the other person is thinking and kind of trying to empathize with them in a different way than I might do if I weren't speaking English day in and day out.
So when you're talking, are you thinking it, like if you're in Japan, not what you are, but are you thinking in English and then directly translating to Japanese in your head? Like my wife is Indian and when she speaks, she's thinking in her native language, Hindi, and then she has to translate it in English. But I'm wondering if you have a similar process.
Typically, I try to not do that because it's not super efficient. Typically, when I'm speaking Japanese, I'm probably thinking at least partially in Japanese and vice versa. There's times, depending on what it is I'm trying to say, if the concept itself, how should I explain it? If the concept itself lends itself more to a Japanese cultural norm, I might actually be thinking about it in Japanese than translating it in English, right? Or vice versa. It depends on what I'm talking about, really, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I suppose. But there's some stuff that you wouldn't be able to translate anyway.
Right. Yeah, certain concepts and ideas that really only make sense in one cultural context or another. Yeah.
Do you like where the video game industry is heading? Do you think that it's going in the right direction or the wrong direction? I mean, I'm sure you're well aware of all these layoffs and things that are happening.
Yeah, that's certainly worrisome.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem to happen in Japan as much, right? Like Capcom has a high retain rate. Nintendo has a high retain rate. Like the layoffs don't seem to be a thing there.
No, Japan's got a kind of a cultural tradition of lifetime employment, right? And it's not super uncommon now, I think, for folks to change companies, but it was almost unheard of, in the 80s during the bubble. There's a certain, they certainly expect loyalty out of employees, but it's a two-way street. There's a certain amount of loyalty you can expect from an employer as well, right? That they'll have your back I think that's very kind of ingrained in the culture here. You don't see a lot of layoffs. And of course, there's laws are different here, right? There's layoffs can only be done under certain circumstances. You have to show, you know, that it's absolutely necessary, that there's no way around it. Have the, you know, has management taken a pay cut sufficient to ameliorate this? Yes or no? Okay, they haven't. Yeah. So do that first, and then you can lay folks. I'm not going to pretend to know all the intricacies of it, but it's certainly more difficult, I think, here to institute those sorts of layoffs. And Japanese businesses, by and large, maybe it feels like sometimes can be a little more risk averse. So they tend to be less likely to get themselves in a situation where they've overstaffed to that degree, because they'll make a series of smaller bets rather than, you know, making huge hiring decisions. But again, I'm not really an expert in that field. It's just kind
no,
of
no, no. I just find it fascinating because obviously I'm not American, and I find American system is quite can be quite ruthless. Corporate America, yeah. Right? You can get fired for anything at any point in time.
Sure. Yeah. Employment at will. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I would think would cause a lot of anxiety. But at the same token, if you've got someone in the company that's dead weight, you can get rid of them quite easily, right?
Whereas, right.
If you had that in, say, Japan or even here, it would be a lot more difficult. I mean, I've worked for companies where I've had, you know, a colleague that is just mucking around, but because of the systems in place, it's a lot harder to get rid of them.
Sure. Right?
Yeah.
Sure.
So I'm sure. So Japan would probably be similar in that regard, if not stricter, I would think.
Yeah, and I think any company, any business is going to have a certain amount of dead weight, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, right? People aren't necessarily working their capacity. And I think they, in the same way that if you run a store, you understand that a certain percentage of merchandise is going to be shoplifted and there's nothing you can do about it. I think there's an attitude of, well, that's just, you know, that's how businesses are run. A certain percentage of people aren't going to overperform, and that's, we'll just include that in our calculations and hope that the top 10% are going to overperform enough to balance it out, I suppose.
Yeah. So do you prefer, I suppose you naturally prefer playing Japanese design games as opposed to Western design games?
Hey, if we're talking about games made in the 90s and 2000s, certainly, maybe less so now. I think there's much less of a gulf between them now. In a good way,
they inspire each other.
They've met in the middle. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I feel like they've kind of met in the middle now. It's kind of I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, a bit of a melting pot. It's much harder now to play a game and to intuit where it was made, where I think in the 90s it was quite clear just based on the control feel or the frame rate or, you know, how responsive the character, oh, this is Japanese because I hit jump and he immediately jumped. It wasn't like, you know, a PC game from the UK in the 80s where you have to hit up to jump instead of a button and he takes a second to jump. And yeah, it's used to be a lot clearer, I think, than it is now.
Yeah. So what's the console you play on the most currently?
Modern PS5, unless I'm playing the Watermelon game on Switch, Suica game. I do enjoy a nice puzzle challenge, that or Picross on Switch constantly. A lot of PS5. I do also find myself still gravitating toward more retro stuff. I play PC Engine games on occasion. I'll play, you know, I've been into, I got my Analog Pocket recently, so I've been playing some Game Gear games and some original Game Boy and GBA stuff.
I think you need to do a 180 or a 360, I should say, of the whole room.
See if I can do this.
Yeah. So just so people can see, because David is not kidding when he says he's a collector. this is some serious stuff here.
Everything's hooked up. I can grab any game off the shelf and pop it in and play it.
So how do you decide what to play? Is it eeny, meeny, miny, mo, flip a coin? Like, what is it?
Sometimes it's literally, I'll just kind of randomly grab something. Sometimes I'll be in the mood for, you know, a vertical shoot 'em up or a horizontal shoot 'em up or a Final Fight style, you know, side-scrolling brawler is a favorite genre of mine. So it's based on mood or sometimes just complete randomness.
Yeah. What's your favorite game of all time? Just out of curiosity.
All time. Oh, man, that's tough. That's really tough. I want to say Shenmue, but I also want to say Streets of Rage 2. Just because of the moveset. No game in that genre has offered even a fraction of the amount of moves and different things you can do in that game. It's a genre that lends itself toward, you can get bored with those games pretty easily if all you're doing is punching and jumping, right? But in Streets of Rage, you can grab people and you can jump over them and you can throw them at other people and you can pick up a weapon and throw it or use it to swing. There's just so many things you can do. You can do a whole stage just doing one move. You can try a different move on the next stage. You can mix them up constantly. just the sheer variety in that game. And the sprite size and the graphics for a Mega Drive game or Genesis game just looks incredible. Even now, the game looks incredible. So I'm probably going to edge towards Streets of Rage 2.
So
that's a hard question, man.
I know it is a hard question. I did put you on the spot.
Metal Gear Solid 3, I can't. Yeah, on any given day, that answer will change.
So do you play games every day?
Most days. But if I don't necessarily play modern games every day, because I don't necessarily have the time to devote, a lot of modern games, and I enjoy playing them, right? Like a big open world AAA game, they're great fun, but they can also sometimes feel like a second full-time job.
Yeah.
And after working all day, I don't want to look at another checklist of missions to do. I'd rather just kind of zone out and play a shooter or something more simple, so I'll pop in a retro game. Of course, there's periods where I get super hooked on a PS5 game. I was really into Spider-Man 2, obviously. Planning on devoting a ton of late nights to Dragon's Dogma 2 next month and beyond. But that kind of comes in waves, right? And then I'll go back to retro stuff for a bit.
Yeah. So, final question before I let you go. But if somebody wanted to move to Japan to get into the industry, what would be your advice to them?
Good question. Just a few pieces of advice. Learn Japanese, or do your best to learn as much Japanese as you can first. And for anybody getting into the game industry generally, interesting piece of advice that an old mentor of mine gave me, which is, it's not enough these days. It might have been 20, 30 years ago. It's not enough these days to just pick, I really like video games. I'm passionate about video games, because millions and millions and millions and millions of people can say that, right? What else do you bring to the table? Maybe you really like video games, but you speak three languages. Maybe you really like video games and you're an expert in Greco-Roman mythology. Maybe you really like video games and you have an architecture degree. What else do you bring to the table? What else can you do that's going to add some depth and some breadth to the team's knowledge base, right? So I would say have knowledge or a hobby or expertise in something other than games, and learn the language would be my two pieces of advice.
Yeah, that's actually good advice. I think I remember reading somewhere that Onuma, who did, the producer on the Zelda games,
sure.
I think when Miyamoto hired him, he made furniture or something. He did some sort of
work.
I think I remember reading that.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that as well.
Yeah. So he was hired because of not necessarily being a developer, but because of his other hobby or skill set that he had.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, back in those days too, I mean, game developer as a career was not a super widespread
thing,
right?
Thing.
So out of necessity, people kind of jumped into that from other fields, right?
Yeah.
A lot of folks that worked at the Capcom, maybe they had backgrounds as musicians or things like that, right? And then ended up doing completely other things later.
Yeah. Well, David, I know you're a busy man, so I will wrap up there. If anybody wants to keep up to date with anything you're doing, is there somewhere they can do that? You're on social media?
I'm not super active on Twitter. This is the part where people like to get their Twitter handle or the X handle. I don't do a lot on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. You can find me under my own name, David Crislip, DavidCrislip. Mostly posting video games and records and pictures of my dogs and stuff. Probably not super interesting. I appreciate the chance to talk a little bit. It's always good to reminisce. Always good to have a deeper and not so surface level conversation about games. It's easy just to chat with people what you're playing these days, but to talk on a deeper level is always fun. So thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking time out. My wife and I have been talking about going to Japan for ages, and Osaka is on the list. So yeah, we will be there
with the yen exchange rate the way it is now, man. Now's the time. Do it now. You get a lot more bang for your buck, so to speak.
Okay, I'll play this part of the interview for her, and I'll be like, hey, he said it. Come on, let's go.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.